Well, hey there, record collectors. Have you seen the selection of jazz vinyl at audiophileusa.com? Holy moly, you are in for a treat. There is a ton of jazz from your favorite labels, including Blue Note, CTI, Prestige, Impulse, Audiophile pressings from Music Matters, Quietex 200G pressings, and more. I just checked audiophileusa.com, and they have 7,590 jazz titles in stock and ready to ship to your front door wherever you are in the world. And you all know AudiophileUSA.com, they only sell excellent and near-mint vinyl records, many of them still sealed and in original shrink wrap. And again, they deliver to your front door no matter where in the world you are. Head over to AudiophileUSA.com. Even if jazz ain't your first love, there's plenty of other titles and genres to choose. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Go there now and find your holy grail. And with that, let's start this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, howdy-ho there, vinyl nerds. I hope you're well. This is Nate. You can hear the rain in the background. Hope it's not too noisy. Thanks again for tuning into The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And we are in the midst of a blizzard of bass playing episodes. This is episode 2 of 4 featuring some amazing bass players. Last week on the show, of course, we had Mr. Mike Watt talking all about his time in the early LA punk scene, the Minutemen, his time with Iggy Pop and the Stooges, and heaps more. Check it out if you haven't already. Watt is an absolutely amazing guest, and today I have yet another one of my heroes on the show who also plays bass, Mr. Ron Carter, bass legend, the most recorded bass player in history, and I'm sure you've heard Ron Carter more than you realize. Here's just part of Mr. Carter's resume. Miles Davis, James Brown, Lee Morgan, Wayne Shorter, Freddie Hubbard, Eric Dolphy, A Tribe Called Quest, and literally hundreds and hundreds of others. And by the way, I only say the names of those artists as they are quite well known, but as you'll soon hear, Mr. Carter values every session he was part of. He doesn't like to talk about the artists individually. He likes to stick to facts, not stories. He talks about music and the personal experience, not people. Mr. Ron Carter is a class act from beginning to end, and he's so cool and he's so knowledgeable, and I know you'll all enjoy this discussion. Mr. Carter shares about working with the famous record labels like Blue Note, CTI, and more. He'll share about playing in the New York jazz clubs in the early 60s, working with Rudy Van Gelder, being sampled unexpectedly, and heaps more. And by the way, this discussion is just a smidgen of the wisdom of Mr. Ron Carter. For more, please head over to roncarterbooks.com. He's got books on playing the bass, as well as a brilliant biography, Finding the Right Notes, which you can get on paperback and audiobook, and that's up at roncarterbooks.com. And by the way, if you enjoy this interview with Mr. Ron Carter, I have several other Vinyl Guide episodes you may enjoy as well, including episode 157 featuring Joe Harley, the guy who is in charge of the Blue Note Tone Poet Vinyl series. You gotta check it out. He talks a lot about the Blue Note tape archive and gives some great information for the audiophiles. That's episode 157 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 105 of the Vinyl Guide features Blue Note Records president and mega producer Don Was talking all about a life in music and the records and music of Blue Note. That's episode 105 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 86 features a conversation on record mastering with Bernie Grundman, episode 86 of the Vinyl Guide. Episode 70 features a conversation with Blue Note session bass player Larry Ridley, talking all about the early days and experiences of playing jazz on all those lovely records, and heaps more. Larry Ridley, episode 70 of the Vinyl Guide. All these are available and heaps more at thevinylguide.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you get these podcasts. And with the upfronts done, let's get straight into our conversation with bass legend Mr. Ron Carter about a life in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
This week on the Vinyl Guide, we are welcoming legendary bass player Mr. Ron Carter to the show. Good morning, Mr. Carter. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Good to hear your voice.
Well, great to hear yours. And I understand that, correct me if I'm wrong, at 2,221 recording sessions, you are the most recorded jazz bassist in history. Is that right?
That title is right. The number is probably wrong since I was 5 years ago, and I'm still pretty active.
So we're probably 2,500 or so, something like that? Actually,
this
is a bit of a recording session as well, so maybe this will increment the number a little bit.
Okay, I'll add to my list of things that wish I had been better at.
Well, I'm sure you're going to be the master of this one as well. Now, can you remember those sessions? I mean, do you ever hear music in the wild and it kind of sounds like you, but you're unclear if it's you or not on that track?
Absolutely. Happens all the time.
Wandering through a store and you hear something over the loudspeaker, you're like, is that me?
Yes, that happens several times a week. Not the current past weeks, but it does happen.
Wow. Now, do you have copies of all your works or the majority of the sessions that you played on?
Well, some are up in Rochester, New York at the Eastman School of Music in what they call the Ron Carter Audio Archives. I have a friend in Baltimore that continues to collect them, and I have a fair share of them in my home.
Got it. Okay. So over the years, you collected all your works and everything, and did you donate it to the school, or how did that come about?
Well, I donated them to the school. I thought that they were in the process of starting some jazz courses and a serious jazz program, and I thought that what a better place to store some information for the kids who are coming up in this business than having records by one of the guys who went there and graduated in 1959.
Not only the records by the guy, but the records from the guy, from your own collection.
That too, yes, that too.
Now, along the years, when you would record a session, for Blue Note or CTI, whoever, would they send you like a little handful of those records or a box of records of that session after they were done?
No, I'd have to remember that I recorded it and make a note on my calendar that if I could see it where it's released, go out and buy one. I was determined back in the day to, when my grandsons woke up and got involved in life, they wanted to know what did my grandfather do, I'd be able to point to my library or point to some source and say, this is what I did since before you were born. It was important to me to establish a level of credibility with whoever my grandchildren would be.
I would imagine that the record companies that you work for would at least send you one or two copies for your own use. They wouldn't do that?
Not of their own volition. You know, maybe given the companies I worked with, some may have, but by and large, they were not so concerned with giving their artist a copy of their most recent work on that specific label.
And when you did work for the record companies, and that, would they give you an idea when something was going to come out?
Not personally. I would see it advertised in the magazine, or if I were the leader, I would know. But given all the assignment dates I had done, I would only know about it came out when the leader told me, or I happened to be by a record store, or someone said, I heard this new record by you, you should check it out. That kind of word of mouth stuff.
I heard this new record by you. You were really good. You should check it out.
Yeah. You've been there. You heard that phrase before.
I've never been there. I was never nearly good enough to get on record. Now, when you are playing on a track, and obviously when you're in the studio, I'd imagine you would get in the zone, you would be in a particular mindset while you're recording. When you hear a playback of that recording, do those memories, does that experience come back to you?
It has been, but again, there's so many choices, I can't remember when was the last time that happened to me.
And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I listen to music, sometimes if I'm at an intersection, sometimes a year or two later, I'll hear the same song and I'll imagine that intersection from, the last time I heard the song. When you play and you hear a playback of that session months or years later, do you ever have those sort of same experiences?
Absolutely.
Same memories? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Not as many as you would imagine, but enough to recall that when I hear this track or the name of the personnel, I would recall that I was at this session with this specific name of a bunch of musicians, or the title of the song may have been stuck in my mind as an unusual title, or the lack of a title is two, number four, four, five, six, rather than a title. So I have those kind of dim memories that kind of lit up when I get fire into that kind of memory.
When you hear some of your sessions, do you remember all the players that were part of that session?
By and large, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow, you've got a really good memory. I'm fascinated by how people file information in their brains.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Occasionally someone will ask me a question and I'll have the answer right off the top of my head, and I'll be surprised that I remember that specific information from the event that happened so long ago.
Now, in the early days, what was the life of a working bass player, working jazz bass player in New York in the early 60s?
That's a pretty general question. Can you give me a little more specific?
Sure.
To answer to?
Sure, no worries. So when you were playing in the clubs in the early 60s, what was a typical week? Were all the clubs open 7 days a week, or was that only limited to a few days and studio time on the other days?
Well, it depended on the club. Some were open 7 days of music, 6 days for music, and a seventh night was off night, so they have a jam band or a jam session that night. The germs of the sets were three sets a night, mm-hmm. 9, 11, and 1 probably. They always started on time, and they would be hanging around until maybe 2 o'clock in the morning after you finished work. The studio days, record days, would start somewhere between 9 a.m., and they would go as long as the project for that particular artist or commercial would last. I was practicing, so I had a pretty full week.
And when you were playing in the different combos and the different bands, how long would you be playing at a particular club? Like, for instance, would you be at Birdland for 2 weeks and then another club for another couple weeks? Like, what was the rotation like?
It was quite different. Back then, I was with Sonny Rollins at the Village Vanguard at the club called Five Spot, which is at the time 3rd Avenue and 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue and 8th Street. With Sonny Rollins and Ron McCurdy on drums, we were there for like 8 weeks. Mm. I was at a place called the Jazz Gallery around that same time with Bill Evans had an 8-piece band I was a part of for 6 weeks. And these places with this multi-run groups had two bands. So I'd have a chance to listen to these bands all week, the opposite band, wherever it was. I played with Tommy Flanagan with a trio at the Five Spot when they had no drums, and I was able to hear whoever the opposite band was for many weeks, as long as Tommy's run was. At the Five Spot when 1959 or so, 1960 with Randy Weston, that was a long run. I worked opposite Ornette Coleman's first gigs in New York, the first gigs of the Jazz Tet, and again the street shows and nights. We'd be there all night listening to music and being a part of the process.
Wow. You heard some of Ornette Coleman's first shows in New York. That must have been extremely interesting. How surprised were you at his style?
I was more dismayed that it was called free music than his style. I didn't agree with that definition at all.
Have you come to embrace the free jazz? I mean, you went from...
I embrace any music that's quality, that makes me think, how do they do this? Or what's just the form of this tune? Or why they picked this key of tempo? I don't have any reservations about any music, whatever it's titled as, whether it's going to affect me or not, depends on how good they play it.
Was it a challenging transition to go from bebop to participating in the free jazz?
Well, I was doing that stuff Don Ellis, the trumpet player, Jackie Byard. I was already involved in that scene. Eric Dolphy, I was already a part of that scene. And I didn't see any line that said, okay, you jump over this line and you play with Sonny Brown, a drummer, or J.C. Moses, and you jump back over here and play with someone who's either the Kenny Clarke or the Philly Joe Jones school. It wasn't that kind of demarcation for me. We had the same notes. We just had a different order of them and our different response to them, and I was trying to find out how that worked as well. No, I was not picking my shots for the music that I wanted to play.
In that time, was there much competition for different positions? For example, you know, yourself or Larry Ridley or Scott LaFaro, or was it more of a very collaborative community that supported one another?
Well, I think the job was who got the call. I mean, I didn't know Scott very well. I knew Larry in passing, but there was no bass community as you might think of, and there was no competitive drive between the bass players who got the job. It depended on who the contractor was, and it depends on who of his friends knew who bass players were in town who could play, who needed to, who could do the job, who were available. And it wasn't that kind of a friendship based on animosity and ranking in the New York hierarchy or lowerarchy of bass players.
But I mean, if there were, you know, a certain number of band leaders and a certain number of calls that they would have to make, would you guys all know that, oh, for instance, so-and-so is looking for a bass player? Would you both have a similar interest in filling that role? Was there any of that?
I would never know that personally. I don't know what anyone else would know, but I was never aware of who's, other than when the leader approached me personally about joining his band for a recording session, or the recording company would call me to join the band for a couple of tunes. I'd only know about those openings in the bands when those people who were in charge of that band would call me. Mm. I would never know it before then. And I wasn't really interested to know that. I'm trying to get better in my house. Can I do that without this kind of outside information?
Well, yeah, I would imagine, again, I guess you'd go from gigs to gigs, and so I would imagine that at some point that was something that would come into your thought process, but maybe not.
Well, again, I wasn't concerned who played better than me. Mm-hmm. I was concerned with, can I play better than I did last night? And that was my only concern.
During this time, like, how consistent was the work? I mean, was it a comfortable living? Was it difficult? What was the ability to make a living of it?
There's a lot of work in New York at that time. There's a lot of clubs that are no longer there, even before this 6-week or 2-month layoff of in the industry itself. There are a lot of places to play. There are a lot of jazz on radio stations. There are a lot of commercials. The jazz bands were in studio orchestras playing behind the big late night shows. The music world at that time in the early 50s up to early 70s, it was full of work for everybody who played good enough to earn the job.
Now, you mentioned the Village Vanguard, and when I think about that period of time, I think of the Vanguard, Birdland. Were those the two big clubs, or were they just, you know, we just know their names now, but there was another dozen of them that were just as good and just as popular in the day?
There's some other that they were just as good, just as popular. Uptown, there was Cigarette, Robson had a club, a club called Small's Paradise that Will Tremblay was involved in. There was Count Basie's that was on the corner of 132nd and 7th Avenue. There was Wells, which is next door to the Chicken and Waffle Place. There were Breakers, a club uptown that had jam sessions all night, all week. There were many places in New York, uptown, that were really mountainous. It was a thriving place. Club Baron. There were about 15 places uptown within the 20-block area that had jazz going all the time, every night of the week. As well as, again, back downtown, you had the Five Spots, you had the Vanguard, you had the Half Note that was running around back and forth. So there were a lot of places to play. The Birdland, of course, was from Pimpson, the Hickory House. There were a lot of places to play then.
Do you have any Pee Wee Marquette stories you could share?
Not with me, but you hear the rumors of how he would mispronounce your name if you didn't give him a dollar. So I never got famous enough to need that kind of money.
Okay. I think he'd really have to try hard to mispronounce your name, though. It's
He was known for doing that on purpose, as I understood the story from the older guys.
Okay. All right, so he wasn't around when you were playing.
He was there, but I never had any contact with him.
It sounds like you would be out in the clubs 6-7 nights a week and then off to the recording studio pretty regularly. How many times, let's say, on a given month were you in a recording session?
I can't remember that far back how many times, but based on the number I've given credit for recording, it's pretty frequently. And then I would go out of town for a while with when I joined Miles, I'd go out of town with Miles' band and come back with a slew of dates. Or when I was working with Randy Weston full-time at night, of course, any recordings at night was out of the question for me because I couldn't send in the sub. I was just learning how that stuff worked. Mm-hmm. But again, that's back and front. I can't give you any specific slots that you're asking me for. But it was a very active time for all bass players. Richard Davis was in New York doing a lot of work. Milt Hanton was live and well. Joyce Vivier was really playing well. Joe Benjamin. I mean, there were a whole load of names of guys who really played the bass who were already in New York when I got here. I was just a new guy on the block, and I had to wait my turn until either they weren't available or they were out of town or they needed a sub to cover a job for them, which is how I probably got probably the easiest way to get started in New York at that time.
from what I understand, you really stuck out, not only just your playing, but your reliability. People could count on you. I think you said you always show up 30 minutes beforehand. And that sounds like it was a pretty unique combination at the time.
Well, again, you know, I was just concerned with my avenue. What it would take for me to be called on for the work that was available. My father made sure that his children understood what punctuality was, how important it was to be to the job in plenty of time to be able to do the job. Concept, it didn't come from one work in New York. It came from my father showing me this is one of the processes to work. Wherever the job was, whoever it was with, whatever kind of work was involved, being there early enough to start the job on time was one of the things he made sure we understood.
Did he support you going into a life of music?
Yes. I mean, he supported me in being a productive citizen, whatever that took, whatever job title that was I ended up by doing to be that kind of person. He was full of encouragement, absolutely.
Mm. And what did he do for a living?
He was a bus driver for the Detroit Street Railway, the DSR, for 30 years when they finally started to hire African Americans back in the day.
Did he understand your drive for wanting to be a musician?
Yes, absolutely. He helped pay for the lessons. He helped me buy an instrument. He would make sure I got to the concerts and my lessons in terrible weather. Absolutely, he was aware of what it took to be successful, in this case, of me wanting to be a musician.
It's wonderful. It sounds like he really instilled a strong work ethic in you as well.
Yes. You sound like that's a surprising thing to a parent to have.
Child. Well, sometimes, and from my personal experience, sometimes parents, they don't always understand why their son or daughter wants to go in a particular direction, and some have a easier time supporting it than others.
Yeah, I don't know those relationships because I only had one family, so I was, and I'm being a little bit facetious right now, but I can't answer that question because my background was not that at all. So how the parents treated their kids and their aspirations, I wouldn't know about that until I got almost to where I am, and I would have students who would say comments, let me know their parents weren't necessarily interested in having them be a professional musician, at this case a bass player. But I wouldn't involve myself in their psychological issues with their parents. That's not my job as a teacher. Mm-hmm. I try to inspire them by the way I carry myself, by my dedication to honesty, being a good performer, preparing myself for the job. I would get that far, but I wouldn't delve into the kind of answers that you're kind of asking me to answer.
When you're working with different band leaders, they each had their different approaches to the music and, of course, the preparedness of the group. Which band leaders were more prescriptive than others?
They all had their own desires of what their band should sound like. And my job as a bass player was to try to anticipate their needs, try to understand what they were once I heard a sample of their music, and fit my hand to that glove as quickly and as smoothly as possible.
And when you were scheduled to do a session with someone like, say, Wayne Shorter or Miles Davis, would they give you the charts, or how much of it was written, how much of it was at the moment?
Well, certain artists would send you the parts in advance. Certain artists would send you an A-track or some kind of cassette recording of the sound that they wanted to have you be a part of. Some of the show music when you got to the date. So it varied with that leader's personal way of preparing his musicians for that session to play his music and give them the best chance of being successful.
And how much notice did you typically get for a session?
It varied. It's overnight, a week, a month, 20 minutes, depending on I would get a call because the bass player for a date was stuck in an elevator or on the highway with an accident, couldn't get to the date, and the engineer would call me to come down to the session within 20 minutes. So it depended on a lot of variables depending on the situations.
Mm, okay. Do you remember an example or an instance when you were called on extremely short notice and did some work that you were extremely proud of that day?
Well, I like to think that I'm proud of any work that I do, whatever time I have to prepare for myself, but I don't remember any specific instances where the bass player got stuck in an elevator, or he got stuck in his garage, or couldn't get out of his garage in time. I know those situations have existed, and I've been calling the sub on some of those dates. The guy was in Chicago and couldn't get to New York because of the strike or something like that. I know those situations, and those people who call for a sub, have a list of guys who they think are reliable and they can do the job on site and don't mind, are not upset about the pressure of lack of preparation before this days that take place. I made some of those lists, and when those base players were unable to get to the session on time, I'd be one of the guys they would consider to call to fill in the slot, whether it's 20 minutes or 2 days.
One of the reasons I've heard about Blue Note Records being such a high watermark, this just very good quality, is that they paid the musicians to practice as well. Is that your experience?
Yes, but I wouldn't say that's the reason why they were high quality. They had just wonderful players. They rehearsed sometimes. They had a good engineer. Mm-hmm. Alfred Lyons would make sure that they got there in plenty of time without having to scramble to find where everybody was. There are a lot of reasons for that. That they got paid for rehearsal was only one of them.
Did any other labels take that sort of investment in the rehearsal time as well?
I'm sure that of my history of making records, I'm sure some labels would submit music in advance, whatever, have a reading of the rehearsal before the recording date took place. Blue Note's probably the best known jazz label to do that. That was their project. They would rehearse 2 days before the session, and you get the Rudy's, and you could do the whole record in one day because you had already rehearsed it. I'm sure there were other labels at the time who had the same process, but they were not noted for giving me the music a week in advance to prepare it for the date that was coming up, whenever it was, the following week or the following month.
Were there any other notable differences between the labels and how they treated the musicians that you can recall?
Well, I think they were. It depended on the musicians. How to say this? It depended if the musician knew his worth. If he had a value on his talent, then he had an idea of what it took to satisfy his needs and how much preparation he would want to need, and whether the demands of the label were realistic and he felt that he would get a fair shot. He'd make certain demands on the label, the producer of the label, to see if they would meet those demands that he thought he wanted, and if they were not able to meet terms, he would either adjust his needs or he would not make those recordings.
So to get to that space, I imagine you had to say no as many times as you said yes.
Well, I have a set of values that I'm responsible for, and the only way you can kind of keep those values in place is you just use them all the time. And if I thought that the date was not going the right way for me, or if I thought that the conditions were not favorable to what I thought I could have a chance to fulfill the leader's requirements of my presence on the date and what he thought I could add to the music, if I thought that the label or the producer was not making that possible, I would let him know that I thought that was unreasonable suggestion, not make my own. It was up to him to accept it or reject it, and sometimes they thought it was being my suggestion was unreasonable, so I would not be called for that date and not accept the risk of having someone say no to me because I've said no to them.
Now, your first album, I believe, is Where, with Eric Dolphy, and that was on New Jazz Records. How did that project come about?
Well, I'd done work with Eric on this record that we did called Out There, a record with Mel Waldron, Joyce Vivier, and Charlie Persip. I can't think of, but we had done three records out at Rudy's for Blue Note at the same time. There was a summer that I was working at Avalok, which was a resort place up in near Lenox, Massachusetts, with the Randy Weston Quartet for the summer. Mm-hmm. We would go up there and play for 4 or 5 weeks, right 4 miles from the Lenox School of Jazz that John Lewis had started that summer. And my getting my own date was a result of being on the other prestige dates at that time. One was led by Mel Waldron, called A Quest, maybe something like that. One was Eric Dolphy's, and mine was called Where.
And so you guys worked directly with New Jazz. They gave you the offer of the three albums? Is that how it came about?
No, I'm not sure how they planned it, but that would result. There were three done all at the same time within a short space of time. Mm-hmm. I had no three-record agreement with that. I just wanted to admit, they said, we have a chance. We're offering you this chance to make a record under your own name. Are you interested? And I said, yes, what are the conditions? And we worked it out, and that's how I made my first record. But it was not a pre-designed situation where they had a three record package in their head, and these three guys fit their description, fit their needs.
Mm-hmm. Is that typically how it would work in the day, that there would be recording sessions after recording sessions, and then at the very end they would go through the material and then compile what the finished record would be?
That's kind of a question that is not clear how to answer that. My job at the time was to make the record play as good as I could, and I would go home. I never knew what the after effect of those, what the end result, how they got to making the real record until it came to my turn to make a record. Mm. Then at that time I became involved in, what is this process? When I play a note in March 1995, when it gets to my house a year later, what does it sound like? What's the order of the tunes for this record? What about who's mixing it? When do I, can I come to the mixing session? Who does the artwork? Who does the liner notes? Who does the cover photograph? I didn't get involved in those questions until my name was on the record as being the leader.
And when you listen to records of your work, your past work, how critical are you of your own performance? Like, are you kind to yourself, or is it sometimes difficult?
I'm very critical, but I understand the circumstances that make those things take place.
So you have a session that resulted in the album Where. I believe that was 61 or early 60s, somewhere around there.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And then fast forward to a decade or so later with an album like Blues Farm. The difference between the two in terms of your musicianship and your approach to making your own music, what had changed in that time?
Well, there's a record in between that called Uptown Conversation on a record that Atlantic Records gave Herbie Mann just so he stayed with the company, as the story I got. Uptown Conversation with Herbie, Grady Tate, a guitar player, Sam Brown playing the guitar. A wonderful record. Just to give you a fill in that space of Where to CTI, one in between there. I'd gotten better. I understood the process more. I understood how to take control of the project. I knew what questions to ask. I thought I knew what questions I wanted to have answered. I knew what my responsibility was to help these guys understand what I thought I wanted to do. I understood the preparation so that when they walked in, they weren't waiting to die, to set to make a decision. I'd really gotten to the details of what makes a record, as I viewed it, a successful project, as near as successful can be done within my control.
And in terms of production, so you'd have someone like Alfred Lion or Creed Taylor. In terms of their styles, which one seemed to work best for you?
They both worked best because I understood what I needed to make them happy. Alfred just wanted to hear us make rehearsals, so we prepared for the date. That's what his concept was. Mm-hmm. Creed would meet in advance to the leader and talk about concepts and length and personnel and the location of recording. That was his kind of detail then, and they both got good results with their different approaches.
Is there a recording experience that you can recall that really taught you so much more than the others, like something that really sticks in your mind as a turning point in your career?
They are all important, and those kind of questions I try to graciously not answer, because it means that I learned nothing from the other dates. I don't want to give that impression at all.
Yeah, well, look, I'm sure every single stone was important on the path, but you know, sometimes there are experiences that provide some strong aha moments.
Well, again, as I explained to you, all those records I did do, it's another. I'm going to school free. I understand how this record, how this engineer records the bass. I understand this different studio room. I understand the different gear. I understand the personalities of the guys who are coming into the date. I understand the environment. And they are all different for all those records I made. No two are alike, and I've always treated these experiences one way, another chance to see how someone else is going to run the show and what part of that can I use when it comes to my turn. So they're all important to me, believe me.
Sure. Okay. So what were some of the more profound bits of knowledge that you learned from, say, Miles Davis?
Here we go again. I'm not going to answer that question because it means I learned nothing from George Benson or Yusuf Lateef or Art Farmer. Or, you know, I'm not going to go there for the question.
Okay. I was just going to say just from Miles. Like, what was something?
I don't answer those kinds of questions.
Okay.
I explained to you why. That means Chet Baker was Art Farmer, Clark Terry, all those guys I played with, they weren't as important to me, and they didn't offer me that piece that makes my career do whatever it did. They all offered me a chance to grow and learn how to play and help them sound good. And I look for those lessons even today when I go to work with a session. I'm trying to find out, how can I help this person sound good, and what can he help me do? What can he do to help me understand better what his needs are? His or her needs are. Sorry, ladies.
Now, you've had such a successful career. What is one of the biggest mistakes you made?
You know how old I am?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, can you imagine at least two mistakes a year?
Well, yeah, sure.
Okay. Just double that, and that's how many mistakes I'm better by.
But give us an example of something that, you know, if you had the magic wand, something that you would like to go back and tell your younger self not to do.
As I've gotten older, I've learned how to do that kind of stuff very discreetly. Otherwise, it messes up my day. So I have that file away in the catalog. Says these are things on the head. Don't do that again. Mm-hmm. But only I know that book and where it is in my library. And it's not to be shared until my passing.
Okay. Is that true? Is there a tome that we will one day open of the wisdom of Ron Carter?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, I hope it's a long time before we read it, quite honestly.
So do I. It's called Tomes Day. No, we don't believe in that here.
Okay. Now, understanding what you've shared about the, you know, comparisons, and this is not a comparison question. You've had a lot of people call you to do a session or record an album. Which phone call surprised you the most?
Any one phone call that comes from a person who, as my view of the music, is not in the jazz community. And I wonder, how does this person know that I exist and he's not, his music is not associated with what I do for a living, you know? And it always surprises me when I get these calls from outside of my genre, so to speak. And what that taught me was music is pretty broad given the limitations that society places on it and the importance that society lets people know that there are a lot of ways to play this B-flat scale, and these are three or four kinds of music that have this scale. Society is not encouraging kids to feel like that. And so anyone who asked me to join their project who is not a part of the jazz community has been able to surround himself with a broad array of music, or people who do have that same broad array of music, and they're able to pick out names from not this person's personal library, but they think that this person who plays, in this case, jazz bass, may have a sound or a set of notes or a reputation of hoping that they become successful. Call this person. And you have to ask those persons how they come to my name. So I could answer that for those people. Mm.
Being the most recorded jazz bassist in history probably means you're likely one of the most sampled jazz bassists in history. How do you go about your baselines, your intellectual property when it comes to sampling?
Well, it depends on what kind of record I'm doing. If I'm going to one of those dates that's kind of a sampling kind of a session, I have ideas in my head and I'll make notes. And when we finish the session, I'll make a note of these notes I played and copyright them. Otherwise, when I hear a record that has my baseline in it, I'll have my attorney whose job it is to track the source of this sample down and make sure that the proper financial rewards are made, given to the person who sampled that they have used without their permission.
Okay, so I imagine quite frequently you're being sampled without permission.
Yes.
Okay.
My sons tell me, well, I never know that. That's not my area of spending time, but people come up and tell me, my sons, so I saw this on TV, and this, you should check this out because they got your baseline on it, or someone, my friends will say that. So I found out about these illegal samples from people who's interested in that what we call sampling genre, and then it's off to the races.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's just put the whole financial discussion aside, is your view on using sampling as part of the creative process, does that sit okay with you? Are you comfortable with that?
Well, I tell those people who sample me that they probably had more choices. They had called me to help make the record for them. I tell them all that who ask me about sampling. One of the things that I'm always amazed with these sampled discs is probably two things. One, that they have the patience to pick through a chorus and pick out a four or five note phrase that needs to be in their project. And two, that they listen to all these records to make that kind of specific choice. That kind of patience and research skills that always stuns me, and that they will sit down and just take a line of mine and put it behind a commercial or put it behind a rap record or put it behind an arrangement. It always amazes me that patience that it takes to do that is on the scene today. It's just kind of above my imagination.
So you get hired to still do a lot of sessions that are just for sampling?
Not specifically for sampling, but those dates I'm on, they're the kind of music that sampling is a part of. Mm-hmm. I just try to protect my interests as best I can by making my physical notes on what I play for this session and give it to the copyright guy. And when they release the record, or anyone who releases a copy of this record and uses my line, this is the sample that goes with it, and this copyright number, wherever it is, and you got to pay me X number of dollars going to the sampling law.
Now, you were part of many legendary sessions with Rudy Van Gelder. Was there any secrets or techniques for getting your bass sound on tape?
When I was first recording Rudy, I would go out there every Saturday for about 6 months. My two sons would be with me. I put them in the corner to read, and Rudy and I would figure out how best to record the bass. Mm. You know, we do is a microphone on this side of the F hole? How far away is it from the bridge? Do I need a separate room? Is this pickup as good as the last one I had? Those kind of experiments, they're personal. And I'm not expecting everybody who plays bass to have a Rudy Van Gelder nearby or have a guy who has that patience.
When you recorded with Rudy Van Gelder, what was the process in terms of setting up? How did Rudy approach welcoming people into the studio? And what was the process that everyone did to get ready for the recording?
There were probably three things that Rudy insisted on. One, unless you were a piano player, you would not play the piano. Two, unless you were working with Rudy, and no one did at that time, you would not touch any of the microphones. And three, if you went into the control room, you would see no names on any of the gear he used.
No names at all on the gear?
Yeah.
Why was that?
Whatever brand it was, the label was taken off.
That's interesting. Why do you think that was?
Well, I have my own reasons, but I don't want to put words in Rudy's mouth and have him. Unfortunately, he's passed away a couple of years ago, and I won't guess the reason that may be so far wrong, and have him not say, "Hey, man, that wasn't right." So, trust me, he had a reason for it, and because he got such a great sound, no one complained about not knowing what he was using. They really didn't care. They wanted to know, "Hey, man, can you give me that same sound I got last week? I was out here."
Was he able to very quickly recall what that was and set it up accordingly?
Yes, absolutely.
It sounds like he had a fantastic memory and a great set of ears.
I'm sure that was the case, because at the time when they were doing editing, they had a quarter-inch tape, and they had the small razor blade and the set of tools. He had a great ear. Otherwise, he couldn't remember the sound, and his ability to do splice stuff was all those engineers. Mm-hmm. Back in the day when they were literally splicing the tape with a razor blade, and they would get the splice just right. I watched that happen when I had time, and I would just be amazed at how they could hear that specific eighth note or millisecond of a sound that was too long or too short. I'm amazed at those guys who had that skill level, Rudy Van Gelder among them.
Do you recall if he had a record-cutting machine in the studio?
My guess is yes. He did all the mastering.
Do you know if at the end of a session with Rudy, if he would drop these things to an acetate or something and hand them to the band leader? Do you recall that?
No, I'd be gone by then, and so would the band leader more than likely, because if the record wasn't released the next week, Rudy had other projects. Mm-hmm. The band leader also had other projects, and it may be 2 months before the schedule of Rudy allowed him to do that project to this fruition, you know?
So recording would begin at 9 a.m. in Inglewood Cliffs. What time would it tend to wrap up? I guess early, because you guys would have to make it to the club that night, yeah?
It would depend on whose date it was and what the issue was. The Blue Note thing, but they would be there until the date was finished, which made me start at 9. You would not leave there until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, depending on the band leader's chops and how complex the arrangements were and how even the performance was. So it would go until 6 or 7 o'clock at night, but we would leave there without having. We would not leave there until the record was finished.
It sounds like you guys would record and play on just about every day of the year, including, I think, Wayne Shorter's Speak No Evil was on Christmas Eve. So 365?
Probably not so many times on Sunday, but certainly 6 days a week.
Well, Mr. Carter, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. I do want to remind folks that if you want to learn more about Ron Carter, you can go to roncarterbooks.com. He's got a biography, Finding the Right Notes, as well as multiple music educational books. If you're a musician or just like reading about them, head over to roncarterbooks.com. Mr. Carter, thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide.
You're welcome, and you be careful and be safe.
Okay, you too.
Bye. Okay, bye.
Oh, there we go. Man, I just got to pinch myself sometimes. I just spoke to Ron Carter. That's incredible. Mr. Carter, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide. It is absolutely my honor to have you, and thank you for sharing those stories and speaking your mind, and of course, drawing your boundaries as well. It's very refreshing, and we certainly do appreciate it. I also want to remind folks, head over to roncarterbooks.com, pick up his biography, Finding the Right Notes. It's a great book. There's an audio version as well. And of course, if you play bass, he's got lots of books on playing the bass. So you can grab one of those and become a better bass player. That's roncarterbooks.com. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. You know, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. It helps keep this show going, sponsor us for $5 or $10 a month, or even more if you can, and you get access to extended interviews, secret episodes, early access to these episodes, and lots more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there, sign up now, that would be much appreciated. And of course, if you're in a position where you cannot sign up for Patreon, that's okay too. Please share this episode on social media and write us a nice review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. That is super duper helpful and much appreciated as well. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.